help me open the meeting with a moment of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. This is a good time to turn off your cell phones. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Trevor Alcoholics. More about alcoholism, page 36 book. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times that we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over a considerable period, we get worse, never better. We are like men who have lost their legs. They never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which makes alcoholics of our kind like other men. We have tried every imaginable remedy. In some instances, there has been brief recovery, followed by always by still worse relapse. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree that there is no such thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. Science may one day accomplish this, but it hasn't done so yet. Despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe that they are in that class. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exceptions to the rule, therefore not alcoholic. If anyone who is showing inability to control his drinking can do the right about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heaven knows we have tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. Here are some of the methods we have tried. Drinking beer only, limiting the number of drinks, never drinking alone, never drinking in the morning, drinking only at home, never having it in the house, never drinking during business hours, drinking only at parties, switching from scotch to brandy, drinking only natural wines, agreeing to resign if ever drunk on the job, taking a trip,
not taking a trip,
swearing off forever, with and without solemn oath, taking more physical exercise, reading inspirational books, going to health farms and sanitariums, accepting voluntary commitment to asylums. We could increase this list ad infinitum.
Thank you. In accordance with our seventh tradition, which states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions, we will now pass the baskets. We have no dues or fees, but we do have expenses like rent and coffee. Thank you. This is a speaker meeting. We have a 10-minute warm-up speaker, Michael. Michael will share his experience, strength, and hope, abbreviated.
Hi, my name is Michael, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Michael.
And I'm also pretty nervous. My nerves started building as it got closer for me to stand up here and talk. But not only, I kind of blew my first opening joke with that. But anyway. So I first got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1986, okay? And I fell in love with it right off the bat. I was in a drug rehab, and the first meeting I got to go to outside of the hospital was this big meeting in Palo Alto. I don't know if anybody was over there. St. Albert's the Great, Sunday morning, huge, like 200, 300 person meeting. The people who spoke there were dynamic, and they had these great stories, and I knew then, right then and there, that you guys could not wait to hear my story. You know? And what I came to figure out was that, you know, I might have drank more than some of you, and I drank less than some of you. I might have done less drugs or more drugs than some of you. It really doesn't matter. But I eventually heard the term, complete and incomprehensible demoralization. And that's the only thing I really wanted to express to anybody. I'd never heard that before, and that's all I felt as I was bottoming out, you know. You know, so I did the AA thing, you know, went to meetings, got a sponsor, worked the steps, got commitments. You know, I think the first commitment was cleaning ashtrays. And, you know, I got promoted to coffee maker, eventually became a secretary. You know, I was a treasurer. I stole as a treasurer. They reelected me as a treasurer, you know. I really enjoyed Alcoholics Anonymous. And at some point in time, I let the life that AA gave me get in the way of my AA life. So I started to wane on my meetings. You know, I'd go to fewer and fewer. Instead of 7 or 10 a week, you know, it became 3 a week, and then 1 a week, and then 1 a month. And, you know, I talked about that incomprehensible demoralization. You know, it doesn't matter who we are. If you're a housewife, if you're a CEO, if you're homeless, if you're unemployed, if you're just a general working stiff like I am, if you're in this room, you've suffered from that incomprehensible demoralization. And I can remember having gone to a meeting, and I stopped listening. I stopped listening for the commonality. And I made a decision that I didn't need to go to meetings anymore. You know? And it's, you know, what happened after that's pretty predictable. I started romanticizing the drink. You know, I started paying a little more attention to Madison advertising the bullshit stuff you see in print or on TV or whatever. You know, and I really romanticized that drink. And when I first got sober, you know, I had a huge ego, surprise. And, you know, I'd tell myself or joking with my buddies in AA that, oh, if I ever go out, the first thing I'm going to do is run to East Palo Alto and buy a bag of heroin and shoot up. So what happened, I was on the way on a business trip. And I was in Europe. And we were having lunch. And I found it easier to say yes than I did to say no. And I met that place, that time, when I didn't have the defenses, and I'd stayed away from AA long, that I didn't have the backbone to say no. And I took that drink. And it was a shandy. And I don't know if anybody here knows what a shandy is, but it's 7-Up and lager. Nikki knows. I mean, there's nothing sophisticated about that. There's nothing badass about it. It's just, you know, it's pretty, you know, it's I just didn't have a defense against it. And I managed my drinking. You know, it was about 11 years of sobriety. And I went out, and I managed my drinking for 14 years. And I managed it by getting a DUI, by running up my credit cards, by cheating on my wife, by getting a divorce. You know, this is how I managed my drinking when I was deep into it. And I don't want to go into war stories or drunk logs, but you know, this might be a typical afternoon. I race sailboats as a hobby. This is probably one of the reasons why I had my shoulder replaced, but that's something else. But, you know, I'm pointing like this is the estuary over there. I don't know. I've turned around. I don't know. But, you know, get back from the boat, have a couple drinks at the Ensenal Yacht Club, you know, then start to drive home and stop at Rooster's, which is a dive bar in Alameda, have a few more. And I might wake up in a parking lot in a warehouse somewhere that I don't know where I'm at. And I wake up from a blackout, needing my GPS to figure out where I'm at and how to get home. I don't know how many times I drove drunk and put the lives of you guys and everybody else in danger, and that's pathetic, and I'm embarrassed by that. And those times I didn't drive drunk, You know, I might have one drink and then go home so I could drink. You know, and that's more miserable, you know, trying to manage that. I cannot just have one drink. If I do have one drink, the second drink takes me. I think we've all heard that before, and that was the case. So, anyway, sometime around 2008, this time around, I started to get sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I'd wake up hungover, and I'd get up to go to work, and I'd be looking at the glass of whatever I had left from being passed out the night before, and I'd shake, and I would or wouldn't drink it. And I'd get to work, and you know, I'd look up meetings online. What's the schedule? Where can I go see a meeting? And then, not see a meeting. Thank you, Robert. But 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, the hangover would wear off, and I wouldn't need Alcoholics Anonymous, and I could not take that drink. You know, and I still had a higher power from the first time around. And I would pray to him. And it's just a masculine pronoun. That's all it is. I'd pray to help reach my bottom. But I would negotiate. Please, not another DUI. I can't afford it. Please don't let me hurt anybody. You know, and I was at a bar. And needless to say, I was drunk. And I'm on the way to the men's room. And I passed someone that I knew early on from Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was someone that the literature talks about. Pete was always an angry guy. And the literature talks about folks who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders. But they too can stay sober if they have the capacity to be honest. And I saw Pete and asked him if he was still sober in his reaction. And he looks up at me with disgust and anger. And he says, 25 years, motherfucker. And you know, and here I thought he was one of those guys that would never get it. And I'm a drunk-ass fool that night, and this guy's sober. I'm humiliated. I give him my business card and ask him to take me to a meeting. And then that next morning, I wake up a little different. And I realized I'd reached out and asked for the hand of AA. Mm-hmm. I asked for that help. Now, I couldn't stay sober that Sunday, but that next Monday, I made it to a meeting. And that was December 12, 2011. So, if I string a few more 24 hours together, I'll have 3 years in 2 weeks. And, you know, Pete was that Eskimo. You hear that people talk about the Eskimo story. You ask for help, and God puts these little characters in your life throughout your life. And I actually was able to see one. And Pete was my angry Eskimo. You know, and since then, I've worked the steps. I've got a sponsor. And, I moved here from Palo Alto in July. And I'm trying to get established in this fellowship. I'm horrible about not networking. Somebody tell me what the word is. Thank you. You know, I don't do small talk. I go out there and it's like, and I just want to scurry off to my car. But, you know, I hope to get to know all of you a little better over, you know, tonight. And you know, I'm not going to, I don't want to say over the years because I don't want to future trip that far. But, you know, I have learned that I suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders. You know, and if I have the capacity to be honest with myself, I don't have to drink, you know. And with your help, we don't have to take that drink today. I'm Michael. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you.
I'm Marilyn, alcoholic. Thank you, Michael. Thank you very much for your share. I'm telling myself, breathe. Just breathe. Everything will be fine. When we were saying the Serenity Prayer, I've always said, God, please help me to carry the message, have some fun, and get my ego out of the way. I'm an instrument. And then I just do my best. I got sober May 22nd, 1979, and because of all of us and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been blessed with not ever having to take a drink again, and that is one day at a time, and I don't take that for granted. I was reading some of the things out of the big book. I was telling myself, okay, 40 minutes. Am I going to be able to make it 40 minutes? All right. Let me open the book and see what it says. And there are certain parts in the book that over the years have stood out for me, and I remember them. But I'm 79 years old, and I get short-term memory loss every once in a while. And I used to be embarrassed about it and try to hide it. Like when I was drunk and I'd like misstep, I'd lose my balance. I'd make believe I was doing a dance step. So because I was embarrassed. But I got over my embarrassment about the short-term memory loss. But one of the things in the big book that has always stood out for me, it's in the preface, and I think it's the last paragraph. It says something like, yes, that happened to me too, and more important, yes, I felt that way too. And then most important, I believe I can have, I can be part of this program. I'm paraphrasing whatever the last one is. And so if I say something that you can feel that way, that you can relate to, that you, that makes you feel like, yeah, I believe I can do this too. When I first, that's great. That means I'm carrying the message, and that's the most important thing to me. When I first came into the program, well, I should back up. I've got 40 minutes to talk, right? let's see. I don't know what I'm going to say, and I'll go back and forth, and it doesn't matter. I grew up in an alcoholic family from Jersey City, and I lived in Jersey City until I was 19, and I moved to New York, and I lived over there for 20 years, and people tell me that they can still hear the New York and New Jersey. Yeah, it's true. Yeah. I don't try to hide it. But you know, when I first came in, I moved from New York to California. I wouldn't let people know that I was from Jersey City because I was ashamed. Jersey City had a horrible reputation. It used to be called Dirty City. And I grew up in the poor section of town, downtown, and now is the historic part of Jersey City. That's where I come from, right? Bullshit, right? So I would just tell people, I'm from New York, you know. Like, and when I lived in New York, people from California, oh boy, one day I'm going to move to California. And people in California seemed to like New Yorkers, so that was my way of, you know, thinking, letting you think I was hot shit or something like that. But you get over yourself after a while, right? Anyway, growing up in an alcoholic family, there were four of us, and I'm the only one in recovery. And my whole family on both sides were alcoholics. My father at the time was a violent alcoholic, so I had a lot of fear growing up as a child. He would, you know, hit my mother every once in a while. I know sometimes she provoked him, and that would make me feel sorry for him, and then I get scared. So it was very conflicting, like when he wasn't, you know how people say, oh, drunks are so much fun when they're not really drunk, really drunk. And he would come home and he'd tell stories. He drove a taxi cab, and I loved sitting on his lap and hearing those stories about people. In fact, when I came into AA, I loved hearing the stories. And one of the reasons why I came back was I wanted to know what happened next. Only I had to ask people, well, what happened? You know, I expected them to keep on talking about the same thing. But he scared me. He scared me. So I was a good little girl. My sister was the bad one, and I was the good one. And I didn't know it, but she would refer to me as Miss Goody Two Shoes. And she didn't like me because it made her look bad. She told me that. I didn't know that. I went to a Catholic school, and I tried to be good. And we had to go to confession every week. And I would try to think up things, you know, sins, right? And I remember one time I told the priest I committed adultery. Right? I didn't know what adultery was. Probably has something to do with something, but anyway, didn't have to do with adultery. And then I would think, okay, I know one of the biggest ones I had was I disobeyed my mother. I was always disobeying my mother. So I got hit a lot. And after a while, all she had to do was look at me, and she scared the hell out of me. So I would try to be good. I got good grades in school. I always liked school. I still like learning. And it was a way of getting approval, too, because I wanted the love and attention from my mother, and I didn't really get it, but I got it in school. And another thing I liked about school was being on stage. Like, we had plays, and we would have, you know, Christmas plays, and I liked to sing, and sometimes I'd sing on the radio, and that got me out of the house as a little girl. I get dressed up. I was able to wear makeup and gowns, and I just loved it. I loved singing. Looking back, I think it was a form of meditation for me. And my mother had this girlfriend. She had a beautiful, she was a coloratura. She had a beautiful, beautiful voice, and she used to sing at the 11 o'clock mass. And we, for school, we had to go to the 9 o'clock mass with our class, but I would go back for the 11 o'clock. And so I got the nickname Holy Mary or St. Marilyn. But I wasn't going there for that. I was going to hear Muriel sing. I just loved her voice. I wanted to be a singer, but as I mentioned, we didn't have money. We were poor. And my mother had four kids, and my father was, you know, in jail or drunk or somewhere. And part of it was, I think, was coming out of the Depression. So we didn't have money for me to be able to take singing lessons. So that was one of the big disappointments for me. Disappointment loomed large in my life. When I did my fourth step, I didn't do it with the topics in the fourth step there in the big book. I didn't do columns. I did it by topics. And all I remember is that the first topic was disappointment. They were just disappointment. I believed people when I was a kid. My mother used to say, you trust too much. You're too naive. And I didn't want to be like, I'm not going to trust you, and then you had to prove yourself to me. I wanted to be the opposite. I wanted to trust you. And then if I got hurt, if I saw that you weren't trustworthy, well, you know, then I learned a lesson. That was the hard way to learn. But I think it was just part of the innocence of childhood for me. So, anyway, I wanted to go to a four-year high. I got a scholarship, but my mother wouldn't let me go. She said, no, you're probably going to get married young, so just go to this accelerated two-year high. And I went to it, but we didn't have, you know, like we didn't have biology, we didn't have chemistry, we didn't have any kind of fun, you know, activities. So I graduated when I was 15 and a half, and I started working for three lawyers. Now, looking back, a 15 and a half year old kid having that kind of responsibility, one was a judge of the surrogate court, another one was a real estate lawyer, and the other one was private, you know, just regular practitioner of the law. And I didn't know it at the time, but what was happening to me was because of all the responsibility they had and the anxiety that would build up, I couldn't make mistakes, I had to be perfect, all of that, I started drinking. Ha-ha! Yeah, surprise, surprise! And in Jersey City, women weren't even allowed to sit at the bar. But over in New York, in Manhattan, you could be, and you had to be 21 to even get a drink. In New York, you could be 18, and you could sit at the bar. So I would get dressed up and put on tight clothes and try to look sexy and have a lot of makeup on, trying to look older. I always hung out with older kids, and I'd have a date, and I'd have them take me over to New York. And I just felt so sophisticated. I remember ordering some kind of a drink, Golden Cadillac or some shit like that. I can't remember what it was, but it was sophisticated. It was like I felt so bad about myself that I tried to pretend that I was other than who I was. I thought that I was less than because we were poor, and there wasn't the term working class hadn't come into play. I mean, that would have been a step up, working class. And I just felt people that had money and people that were able to go to college, they were better than me. And, you know, society had a lot to do with that, too, even to this day. If you have money, then, you know, you're better than, or people look up to you, whatever. But it was the way I was feeling inside, and I was a very self-conscious kid. I remember when I was around 15 or so, I was on the beach in the Jersey Shore, and I was digging my feet into the sand because I had bunions, and I didn't want anyone to see that my feet would be formed. I would try to enunciate. I would try to get rid of the Jersey accent, because if you sounded that way, then that meant you weren't educated, and so therefore you were less than. All of those things. When I'll go back to before I went to high school, as I said, my father sometimes could be a violent drunk. My father was being the alcoholic. I have no idea when he was in a blackout and when he wasn't. But when I was around, my mouth is getting dry. When I was around 8, oh, thank you. Okay. When I was around 8, my father molested me. And I must have had some inclination that was going to happen, because we were down at the Jersey Shore. My mother was in the hospital, and I didn't know it at the time. It was because she was having an abortion. She had 4 kids already. I knew he was going to come into the room. We had a bungalow. And so what I did was they had like a hook, a hanger, and I turned it to the side so it would block the door from being opened. So there was something inside me that knew. Maybe I had no recollection of it before that, of being molested. And I was sleeping with my sister. I hope this is not TMI. But anyway, it's my experience. And he you know, went to push open the door, and I got quiet, and he said, Marilyn, open the door, open the door. And he scared me, so I got up and I opened the door. And he got into bed with us, and I was like this, you know, frozen. You know, he's told about fight or flight is also frozen, freeze. Then he said, put your sister in the middle. And then I don't know what happened after that, like I blacked out. And I tried to talk to my sister about it to see what her recollection of it was, because sometimes, you know, when people or kids are molested like that, you think it's your fault or it's not really true. It's kind of aberrated. And she wouldn't talk to me about it to this day. That was a long time ago, and she can't handle it because she's not in recovery the way I am. She doesn't look at herself, you know, the way I do. But I was able to. I was sitting in a meeting, and all of a sudden the thought came to me, my father could have been in a blackout when that happened. I don't know. That's not condoning it. That was part of me trying to forgive him. And so I was able, there's one alcoholic to another, right? So I was able to forgive him for that. But what happened was I told my mother about it a couple of years later, and she said, you're going to have to go to court and tell the judge. And I said, oh, my God, you know, like, I didn't. And that's a horrible thing for a kid. I was about 11 by then, 10. And to tell that story to a judge in that kind of atmosphere in the courtroom and so forth. But what she wanted to do was she wanted to get him deported from the city so he couldn't be around us. So I just remember, and the judge said, okay, come into the chambers, so it was closed. But my father was sitting there. And that was so hard to, like, tell that story. And my father started crying, right? And he said, put me in jail, I'm no good, you know, whatever. The next thing after that was my sister, and I don't know where the hell this came from, but my sister said to the judge, I only have one question. And my father, and the judge said, what? And she said, is my brother, the firstborn, my father's child? And I looked at her and I said, oh my God, she's accusing my mother of sleeping with somebody else, right in front of my father. I couldn't believe. So I don't know what that story was about, whether he told her that or what it was. But he did get deported, but he still would come back into the neighborhood every once in a while, and I would run. I was just so filled with fear about him. And as I said, it was conflicting because there was a part of him that he was my father, you know, and I guess I loved him. I never felt it, you know, I don't remember feeling it, but that was, you know, that was that. I haven't told that story in a long time. I don't know why I told it, but anyway, the time's going by, so that's good. So, I, as I said, hated Jersey City. So, here I am, I got a job with these three lawyers, I'm making my own money, I think I'm all grown up, and I'm contributing to the household, room and board it was called, I don't know if it's still called that or not. I was able to buy my own clothes, and I loved having, you know, pretty clothes, and going over to New York, and I decided that I wanted to live in Paris. So I had an uncle, my mother's brother, that was in the Navy, and so he moved out to here to California, Whittier. And so I wrote to him, and I said to him, I guess I was 16 or 17 by then, what do you think about me, you know, going into the Waves, the women's part of the Navy? And he said, no niece of mine, I don't want to, and you know, it's no good to be in peacetime in the service, so forth and so on. So if he had said yes, he thought it was a good idea, I would have gone. And thank God he didn't say yes, because I didn't like to be told what to do. So, so that's a really good environment to be in, right? Still to this day, I don't like to be told what to do. I was glad that the book says suggestions. They're mighty strong suggestions, mind you. But don't tell me what to do. So what I did was I met this guy at a dance, and he was going to college, and I thought he was an intellectual, and I was just enamored of him. He was an alcoholic. I did not know that at the time. I didn't know that I was, you know, an alcoholic. I was drinking quite a bit by then, on the weekends, because during the week I was working. So what did I do? I got pregnant. I was a good little Catholic girl, you know, you're 17 years old, you start feeling certain things, and we were going to get married, so it was okay, because I was going to get married, and I found, and he went into the army. He was going to NYU, and then he got deferred, but then he decided he would go into the army, and I figured, oh, well, I could go to Paris with him. He could get stationed over there, right? And then I found out that I was pregnant, and I said, oh, shit. And at the time, I said, nobody's going to have to marry me. So I didn't tell him. I was back in Jersey City, and he was in Augusta, Georgia. And he came home, and he called. I know what it was. He said he was a poet. And I found that he had plagiarized poems that he wrote to me. And I thought they were all about me and how wonderful I was. And, oh, was I ever mad, right? So I didn't tell him I was pregnant, but I called off, you know, they had bans. You have to, you know, in the Catholic religion, you have to post bans, it's called. It's notification that you're going to get married. So I just wrote to him and told him, no, I wasn't getting married. So he came home, and I didn't have anybody to tell that I was pregnant. And I wanted to get an abortion because I didn't want to have a child, 17 years old. And I tried to abort, but it didn't, you know, it just didn't happen. It was very, very dangerous in those times, in the old school, olden days, right? So, anyway, he came home and I just started crying, and what it was, I needed some support, I needed some understanding, and he was the one that I went to. So he said, okay, he said, we'll get married, you come down to Augusta, and I know a doctor down there, he'll do the abortion. I said, okay. So I go down there and get married, and my mother said, Marilyn, you are just in love with his mind. She could see through him, but I couldn't. I just had him up on a pedestal. I wanted what he had. I wanted the information. I wanted the knowledge. I wanted the book learning. And I tried to get it through him. So I go down there, and you know what? There's no doctor. He lied. He was a pathological liar, and I didn't know that. So, you know, I had the baby, and I'm glad. I'm glad that I had the baby. She's 60 years old now. She's no longer a baby. And she has a son who's 29. That I'm very, very happy that I didn't have that. It wasn't in the cards. So I go back to Jersey City, and you know what? He got stationed right outside of Paris. He was I ever mad about that, right? Here I am. We were brought up in the Irish culture, and I'm part English and Irish and Cherokee, but we were brought up in the Irish culture, and he was Italian. His parents, I don't know if it still goes on or not, the Irish didn't like the Italians didn't like the Irish. And my mother said to me, "You made your bed, lie in it." I said, "Oh, shit," you know. Like, so I had no place to go, so they said, well, because I was carrying their child, and it better be a boy, the father said, right? Later for that, I knew I was having a girl, I could just tell. And I did, right? So anyway, I had to live with these people, and they didn't like me at all. I was Irish. I got pregnant before we got married. It just was awful. So he was over there for 10 months. A year. I had the baby, and it was very difficult living in that family. And I was 18 years old, you know. And I remember talking to the boy across the street. His name was Rocky. He was in the seminary, and I didn't really know that, but he was about the only one on the block that I could have a conversation with, that it wasn't about baby clothes, or it wasn't about who wore red slip or bra or some shit like that. And it was gossiping, you know. And somebody, I don't know who it was, wrote and told him that I was having an affair with the guy across the street. And that would never enter my mind because I was still that Catholic girl, you know. And so when he wrote to me, you know, about that, I just wrote back to him and said, "You may be the father, but you're not going to have anything to do with this child. I will not give you the satisfaction of leaving you before you come back, but I will when you come back." And I did within 3 months. I tried, but he was studying psychology, and he would mind fuck me. He would give me honest. He would give me Rorschach tests, which I really liked. And I wanted to study psychology, and so I would read his textbooks. He went back to college, and he would tell me that. Word association test, and then he told me I was a latent lesbian, and I liked that. I thought, oh, I liked that. It fit, right? It felt good. And then he told me I was subconsciously in love with my brother, all kinds of stuff, and he would just drum at me to one point where I just lost it. Meanwhile, I'm drinking a lot with him. Happy to talk about drinking. This is an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. That's what my sponsor says, is if you're in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, talk about alcohol, right? So he and I would get sloshed just to sneak it in there. And finally, I just kind of lost it. I remember crying and screaming, and it scared the hell out of him. Was it something I said? finally, you know, I just stormed. I remember picking up a plate, and I was aiming for him, wore glasses, and I was going to right at his eyes because I just couldn't handle it anymore. I snapped at the last minute, and I threw the plate down and ran out of the house, and I went to my mother, and I told her what was happening. I said, "I'm afraid I'm going to lose my mind if I stay with him." And so she said, "I can't tell you what to do, but if that's where you're at, well, then leave." So I did. And I moved over to Greenwich Village, and I looked for the dyke bars, right? I'm trying to be true to myself, right? And I found them, right? And I found weed, and I found all kinds of pills, and I found a lot of things. And I found the other people that were couldn't handle their feelings, wanted to be, I just wanted to be oblivious. And I found like-minded people. And so that went on for, and I had my daughter. She was only a year and a half when I left, about that. And at the time, there were no nursery schools. The kids had to be 3 years old. So I was working down on Wall Street, and I would pick her. I have to go over to Jersey City, pick her up, bring her back for the weekend, and then go back. So I was drinking in the cafes and the bars during the week at night, and then it was just getting worse. See, I didn't know that I was an alcoholic. I knew the word drunk because my mother would say, I threw that drunk out. But I didn't know alcohol. I didn't know about anything about alcoholism. I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. But that's what I was doing. It was getting worse and worse. So finally, what happened was I started getting involved with drugs. I met somebody, a jazz musician, who became world famous after that. But I got heavily, heavily involved in heroin for about 10 years. And I knew that my daughter did not belong with me. The kind of life that I was living was no life for a child. So even though I didn't want to, I brought her over to her father's parents because I figured at least this way she might have some semblance of a nuclear family, and I would try to pick her up on weekends, except sometimes I was in jail and I couldn't pick her up. But I did my best. And sometimes I was sick, but I still picked her up, dope sick. So anyway, I went into a drug program. I was able to stop that, but everybody in the drug program drank. It was like Synanon. It was called Phoenix House. And we were given permission after a while. So I'd go out with the directors, and we'd all get sloshed, and I'd fall down the stairs trying to climb them. And it was a two-year program, but I would never had to use heroin again. But I made up for it by going back to my first drug of choice, which was alcohol. So I only have about 10 more. Listen to me. I only have about 10 more minutes, right? And I was worried about 40 minutes. Let's get into the solution, Meryl. So anyway, I was in a relationship. I told her she didn't do something about her drinking. I was leaving. So she did. Very surprising. But I was glad when she would go out to meetings because then I could just, drink and preludes at the same time and just get out of it completely. I tried so hard, and I was very successful. But what she did one time was she left this book on the table, on the coffee table, and in the fly leaf she wrote, I hope the promises come true for you the way they are coming true for me. She put pages 83, 84, I believe. And so I looked at them, and when I read the promises, I said, wow, could this really be true? The one that stood out for me was, you will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. And that struck me because I was always intuitive. In fact, if I had listened to my intuition, I wouldn't have wound up in jail as often as I did. But, you think you're different. That happens to other people. That doesn't happen to you. But surprise, surprise is right. And that was no laughing matter. And then I saw a chapter that says to the agnostics, because I went from being a devout Catholic little girl, of course, the opposite extreme, an atheist, right? That's what alcoholics do, right? Opposite extremes. So 8 months later, I came into the program, and I did not want to stop drinking. I didn't want the ramifications anymore. I didn't want the hangovers, the blackouts. I got arrested once. It's a common drunk. I mean, really. What? A common drunk? Are you kidding me? I mean, I wasn't even dope sick. I was just drunk. So what was I doing in jail? I didn't understand that. It didn't compute for me. So But what I did was I came into the program. A lot of things happened before it, but anyway, I came into the program, and I was very, very angry because I had to stop drinking. You just did a little dance there. And I didn't drink a day at a time, and I still don't drink a day at a time. I listened to what people were saying, and I thought, okay, now, collectively, this is power greater than myself. You're all power higher, greater than me. You're all staying sober. I didn't know how you were doing that. I didn't know how I was going to do that. So I was filled with desperation. And as I think I first heard someone in my home group say, the gift of desperation, I wasn't a gift at the time, mind you. Didn't feel like a gift to me. Didn't look like one. Anyway, it was, looking back. And I was filled with despair and fear, and I kept coming back. I just said, well, if you could do it, and I listened to the stories attentively, and sometimes just looking for the loopholes, too, and then I can do it. All right. So I got railroaded into a service position when I had 2.5 months. It was an atheist agnostic meeting. I got sober in San Francisco. It was at 99th Street, a little storefront in the Mission. And it pulled me right in. Just what I needed, because I was kind of like 1 foot in, 1 foot out. And it was fear that was keeping me from drinking. It was a healthy fear, mind you, but I didn't. Anyway, it turned out that, yeah, and one of the things I liked about being the secretary was I could ask the stars of AA to come and speak, right? Because it would make me look good. You know, just because you stop drinking and using and you come into AA doesn't mean you change overnight, right? It takes a long, 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 long time. And I was just saying in a meeting last night that it was when I hit 10 years of sobriety, I remember saying, my God, I was really crazy. I was really insane. I had no idea how insane I was. The things I did to myself, to other people, the situations I put myself in, it was insanity. And I had the nerve to balk at the second step when I first came in. So, because it didn't apply to me. You know, I was crazy, yeah, kind of cute, but not insane. And so, the beat goes on. I've been doing service all this time. And sometimes it's been easy, sometimes it's been hard. I was able to let go of a lot of my anger. Working the steps helped a lot. It still does. I'm very, very grateful for those steps. And I know there is one line in the big book about cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness. And I came in thinking, I'll use you, you don't use me. But now I want to be of use. And I'm not afraid anymore of being taken advantage of, which I was at the time. And I only have a few more minutes. So there's something in here in the story. He lived only to drink, and it's the last paragraph. And I just love this because it's been my experience. I can so relate to it. And to me, it's the gospel truth. The AA way of life is a blessing and a privilege beyond estimate. A blessing to live a life free from the pain and degradation of drinking and filled with the joy of useful, sober living, and a privilege to grow in sobriety one day at a time and bring the message of hope as it was brought to me. And I hope I've done that tonight for you.